called.
Yeah.
The date is June 21st, 1977, and I'm talking with currently Reverend Dobson, who was formerly a flight lieutenant with the RCAF and then the RAF. Reverend Dobson, could you give us a brief rundown on your family background, where you were born, and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a native of Duncan, Vancouver Island, British Columbia, the second of four sons, all born there, and we have not had military tradition in our family at all. My father had his own business and was not in the first war. Apparently, enlistment was governed partly by a person's independence or whether they were married and had a family. And if you were single and had no financial attachment and so forth, you were more or less expected to join up and so forth. I suppose he could have joined up had he wanted to, but it was something I suppose he decided for himself. The district was a very loyal district with a very high rate of enlistment in both world wars. But, as I mentioned before, we were not a family, really, that had any military traditions. And yet one could see in my generation that there was going to be a very serious situation in the world with the rise of Hitler. And, of course, following the Great Depression, I was one of the lucky ones who, on coming out of high school, was able after a year to get a job, and I filled in that year by studying senior matric on my own, and that helped me to get a job at the end of the year, and I worked for 5 years during the Depression, after which I had saved some money and thought I would go to university, which I did, going to Edinburgh in Scotland because of a friend who had been in our district during the Depression and worked at one of the sawmills, and he went back to further his education and persuaded me by mail to come over, which I did.
And what year was that?
1936. I left for Edinburgh and I graduated in 1939. It was an MA degree because they didn't have BA degrees in Scotland. The distinction was MA Ordinary or MA Honors, and mine was MA Ordinary, and the war broke out just when I completed my MA Ordinary course.
Did you enlist shortly or immediately upon the breakout?
No, I came home to Canada and tried to join up here, but there wasn't very much doing at that time. The distance, I suppose, had something to do with the difference in outlook. And after waiting for about 6 or 8 months, I got on a Greek freighter, which was carrying lumber, to England, and went through the Panama Canal on this freight, and that was a very interesting voyage. They charged me only $40 for the trip since I told them I was going back to join up. Mm. And it was a very mixed crew, but entirely a Greek ship and not a very seaworthy. It was an old British war server class, I think, of 1917. The radio operator was a New Zealander, and I spent the time learning the Morse code, little realizing that I was to use it later on.
What was your motivation for joining the Air Force, and why the Air Force rather than the Army?
Well, I had been in the Officers Training Corps of the Army while I had been at Edinburgh University, and prior to that I had been in the Canadian Non-Permanent Active Militia, NPAM. And I decided that there wasn't enough freedom of movement in the Army, at least not to rank with that which promised in the Air Force, so I was able to choose, and I chose the Air Force.
By freedom of movement, what did you mean?
I would see it from the standpoint of being in an organization where you were subject more to discipline and couldn't exert your initiative to the same extent. I've never been able to prove that myself because I never did serve in the Army under war conditions, and I liked the Air Force from the time I got in it.
Did you elect to take a signals course, and how you received your commission, obviously, because you had a degree? How did they select you for what you and for your role in the war?
Well, you had a choice. You sort of enlisted for air crew, and they more or less, you know, decided what you were probably good at. I took a little experience as far as piloting was concerned, but I didn't feel that was what I wanted to do. And I don't think really my eyesight was as good as it should have been, because I'd worn glasses since 1937. And I never did regret remustering, as it were, to wireless. Besides, I had already learned the Morse code on this Greek freighter, and there seemed to be something suggesting that that was what I ought to do. And it was just as simple as that.
I see. What type of training, how long was your training, and so on?
Well, we were at basic wireless school. You had to get up to 18 words a minute, and then you were airborne. And we flew in some very old aircraft, including de Havilland biplane. I remember one of the pilots was a Polish officer who had been among those successful enough to escape from the continent. And then we had a short gunnery course on the Isle of Man, and you were officially a wireless operator air gunner. I took the air gunnery course pretty well on Blenheim aircraft, and that was what you were turned out for. And they were in great need, because the Air Force was expanding at that time into four-engined aircraft, and they needed air crew.
How long was your training before you assumed an operational position?
Well, partly it was dependent on your postings, but I would say from the beginning of the wireless course until the completion of the gunnery course would be, oh, I would think 9 months.
I see. And then what were the duties of a signals officer on a...
Well, I served as a sergeant first, and you came out of your training as a sergeant, and you were recommended for a commission. And I was commissioned in the RAF because I was a member of the RAF and joined the RAF, you see, before I sort of remustered into the Canadian Air Force at the end of the war. And I was recommended for a commission from our course, and was made a pilot officer in 1942.
As an already trained
wireless operator, yes. I was never in a gun turret during operations at all.
What would be the difference between a wireless officer and a wireless NCO?
Well, I would say it was just a matter of perhaps living conditions, and you're messing might have been a little better. I don't know that it had any sort of basic difference. So we were extremely friendly group and mixed without any regard to rank at all. And this was what I had had in the back of my mind as a sort of ideal situation.
I see. So there was no significant difference in the nature of the task that each performed.
Not really. You had you were airborne. You see, and that's when you really had most of your work to do, and there were not heavy duties, off duties on the ground. You know, on the apart from your flying duties. When I was in the RAF, before I got on course, and this was what you had to do, wait to get on course, I flew at one station there as an AC-1, and we received a shilling a day flying pay. And as an AC-1, I think I probably got 4 shillings and 6 pence a day, maybe 5 shillings a day. And then I got a shilling a day flying pay, and I flew 100 hours on this station in Blackburn Bothas, which... didn't enjoy too high a reputation with the boys who flew them. They were a high-wing monoplane, twin-engined, and they had a torpedo bay, and I understand they were built to Air Ministry specifications, but never actually saw operations, and they were used on this coastal command training unit for observers. And there were a number of accidents on this station, some caused by weather, and others probably the cause of which I never learned to know. But they're regarded as a kind of a semi-dangerous type of aircraft.
I see. You eventually were a flight lieutenant.
Right.
As a you still were a signal specialist.
Well, when I was promoted to flight lieutenant, of course, I was on a Canadian squadron, and that was my second tour of operations, and I went to them as signals leader, in which I was in charge of all the wireless operators on the squadron and responsible for them and for some of their... training and so forth, not towards their qualifications, but keeping their hand in on non-flying days.
So it was a ground job?
No, I flew with, I flew 27 missions as a flight lieutenant, but never with a fixed crew. Different pilot nearly every time, which I suppose there was some risk attached to, but I was extremely fortunate.
Well, would you act as a wireless operator for the squadron when you were in the air, or would you just be another wireless operator?
I was just another wireless operator, because each aircraft was more or less a unit in itself, and if there were any special broadcasts that had to be made to the squadron and operations as a whole, they were made by... WT to the aircraft, and they would be taken by each wireless operator in turn. For instance, such things as being diverted from your home base if the weather closed in before your return, which happened not infrequently.
Mm-hmm. You flew 27 missions. Could you run through a typical mission on a step-by-step basis as you saw it?
Yeah, I had 47 missions all told in the two tours I did, one with the RAF and the other with the RCAF. We were all briefed together, and all the trades, you know, and jobs in the aircraft were together, each crew. And then the target was explained, and if there were any special instructions for wireless operators, they were given by the briefing officer. But usually, we did not have a heavy load of work at all, but every aircraft more or less had to have a wireless operator for communications in case, as I say, weather closed in. And towards the end of the war, there were other things which wireless operators were called upon to do. For instance, they had a metallic shredded ribbon, which was called tinsel, and was dropped in certain areas, and that was to more or less play havoc with the radar pickup. And then you had an electronic device called a fish pond, which sent out a signal, and it was reflected back, and you were able to pick out other aircraft which showed up as a blip on the screen of this fish pond device. But that was near the end of the war. But really, I would say wireless operators got through the war without too much heavy work to do. And I had no idea that I had chosen so well.
While you were, after the briefing, what did you do then?
Well, you'd already done your DI, or daily inspection, and you were responsible for the condition, you know, of your equipment in conjunction with the ground crews. You got to know your ground crews, your ground crew very well, and they were the best fellows and worked very closely with air crew, and that seemed to be the secret of much of the morale which was built up. Good relations, and you felt better. And we only had good relations because we realized how necessary they were. And you were, of course, on WT silence, but you had a listening watch to do, and you had the broadcast from base, you see, coming out regularly, and by that means you were able to test whether your set was okay, because you kept it on most of the time, but you were on WT silence and could not transmit. And I used to go around the dial a bit and listen to some of the German instructions, you know, from ground to air. It was rather interesting, but I was off the main intercom most of the time I was in the air, and I never used to interfere with any of the other instructions between, say, the pilot and navigator, the pilot and the flight engineer, or the gunner's sightings to the pilot, or things of this kind. I kept pretty much to myself because I felt this was the nature of the task, and we never had trouble really with fouling up the intercom with too many on it. We were more older crew, you see. I was getting on in those years. I wasn't as young as a lot of the others, and the RAF crew that I was with, there were three of us, 28 years of age, and one older, and the other three, there were seven in the crew, were only slightly younger, and it seemed that the older crews were probably steadier.
Even though they were more likely to have families than that.
Yes, and that might have been one of the reasons, I suppose, which accounted for their steadiness. They were remarkably so. As I say, it seems to me that I was destined to get through the war, and looking back, it seems that everything was put together to achieve that end, and it did, and I was terribly grateful.
What, when you use the term unsteady, what would be what sort of characteristics?
Well, for instance, one daylight raid we were on when I was with the Canadian squadron, and we were coming back and ran into fog, you see. Well, this young pilot and this aircraft messed around in the fog, and I wondered what he was doing, you know, and I was on the set, of course, and I suggested it might be wise to get above the fog, because the fog, you know, has a limit and was not that deep. And we were in the area of Rugby, you know, and they have some fairly high towers there. And as transformer or transmitting stations and whatnot, but of course we're never in danger of colliding with those. But just the same with other aircraft milling around and expecting a diversion, because this is what I got from base, you know, there was no point in running unnecessary risks. So as soon as we got above the fog, it was bright sunlight. And as we broke into the sunlight, I got a message diverting us to, I believe it was Litchfield. And of course, I just told the navigator that, and he knew practically where he was, and we got a bearing on it too, and we were able to land there without further event. But there seemed to be too much, you know, playing around, I thought, rather than doing what seemed to me to be called for, get out of the fog, get above it, and it was bright daylight, you see, it wasn't night, and as soon as we got out of the fog, lifted up, we were right in the sunlight, you see.
I understand the British used a radio fixing device. Would that have been the navigator's responsibility or yours?
Well, my responsibility is, of course, we're just to work with the navigator on some of the navigation exercises we had during our training. You see, when we were put together as a crew, we had to go on in twin-engine aircraft on night flights and so forth. And they would have sort of beacons, and they emitted their own signal, and you would tune in several beacons, and they were in different positions, and that would enable the navigator to take a fix by, you know, the readings you got from the beacons, and he would plot them. And of course, the matter of a radio fix is when you actually are in touch with a station and you put down your key so that they can take a reading on you.
Oh, I see.
And they can tell you, you know, your position by your transmitting. You see, a sort of a steady transmission, and they pick up the signal, and then they can tell where you are from the stations they have, you see.
What about radio aids to allow more accurate bombing, especially at night?
Oh, there were electronic devices, but with a good clear night, it was instrument, you see, with the bomb aimers department, and the thing he insisted upon more than anything else was that the pilot was flying steady, so his instruments were not thrown off, you see. And that, of course, was the minute that, or the seconds, if you like, part of a minute that always seemed to be a year, particularly if the searchlights were coning people around you and the flak was loud enough for you to hear. And when you could hear it, you knew it was getting too close, because you had four engines and you had all your gear, you know, and your helmet and so forth. And if you could hear the flak, as we did several times, it once in particular, it was getting a little too close for you.
You weren't actually, the plane you were in was never hit, was it?
No, no, we were extraordinarily fortunate, and it was something I'll never be able to understand.
What was the closest you got to?
As I say, I was off the intercom a lot because I didn't wish to foul it up at all for the other fellows, you see, and I was doing my watching and listening. But sometimes when we got back, the rear gunner would say about something having gone fairly close, or the mid-upper gunner would say something gone fairly close, and at times I would look out and you could see somebody orbiting below you. Probably he was a little too early, because you were in waves and each wave had its time on target. So that if you were early, you either had to disobey regulations or do an orbit. And if you were orbiting in a stream, it carried all sorts of risks, because at night you just have no means. I don't know how many aircraft were lost by collision, either mostly our own aircraft or even with enemy fighters. I have no means of knowing that, and I don't suppose anybody else has. It was really the high point of a raid, of course, when you were over the target, and it certainly wasn't very pleasant. And if you were on the later wave of a raid, for instance, we were, I think, in Essen, over Essen three times, Dusseldorf about the same, you know, Bochum, Dortmund, all in the valley of the Ruhr in that spring of 1943, you saw some evidence of terrible fires on the ground. And it seemed to throw a light as high as you were, too, which would probably be 18,000 feet. Some of the fires were deadly-looking things, and you felt more or less exposed under those conditions.
This was similar to the sort of bombing that was done to Hamburg and until Dresden, I believe, was the last one.
Yeah, most of our targets in the early 43 that I was on were more or less industrial towns, you see. Valley of the Ruhr was the big thing, but there were other raids, a couple on Berlin, one to the Skoda Works in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, when we were airborne 10 hours and 40 minutes left in the daylight and actually touched down in the daylight. Flying all night, I went into Europe and through southern Germany between Stuttgart and Nuremberg, and then climbed up to Czechoslovakia. I remember seeing the outline, looking out that night, because it was a long way to go, and seeing the houses well below us laid out in their, you know, usual city pattern. But I doubt very much whether that was a successful raid, but perhaps it was psychologically. I'm only going on what I heard about its results.
Did what the British philosophy behind bombing was to lay a carpet area bombing as opposed to the American precision type bombing. Now,
well, I would say the British system had exactly the same aims, but we were mostly night bombing, you see, and you had pathfinders who went ahead and took greater risks, in my opinion, and their flares were the means of identifying targets for the waves which followed them. And that's why they were called pathfinders, whereas the Americans flew in the daylight and were pinpointed to oil targets, and they fought a bloody and deadly battle in the air, and I would say it must have been a great cost to personnel.
Right, the planes would come back with gaps in the formations It's been you were with an air station as part of an air group. Which was commanded by a group or a wing commander?
Your squadron commander was a wing commander, but your station commander was a group captain.
Right.
And you might have two squadrons on your station, and then your station was part of a group. I was with four group in the RAF and then six group RCA.
And there were how many planes in your squadron?
Well, in the squadron 158 of four group, I would say we had about 20, three, but we were decimated twice in the 6 months I was on 158 in the winter of 42 to about June or July in 1943. And the loss rate was then running about 5%.
Per month or?
No, per raid.
Per raid.
I mean, for instance, they had a raid on Peenemünde where the rockets were
right.
being developed. I wasn't actually on that raid, but I think they lost 42 bombers on that raid, for instance. Closest I ever got to that was a raid on Gdynia, which was the Polish port on the Baltic, and our navigator got an aiming point picture that night, and which was really something that everybody took pride in, because your camera worked in conjunction with your bomb release, you see, and it took this picture as your bombs were going, and you could tell from the developed results of that and the comparing it with the target area maps which were available how close you were to having the aiming point. I believe we had an excellent navigator. He died this last year. He was an accountant for the London County Council. As I say, he was probably the oldest man in the crew. He would have been a little older than those of us who were 28. But we were a mixed crew, Canadian and British, even in the RAF.
What type of, did this casualty raid, did that cause a bit of tension, I suppose, on the at the height of the bomber offensive?
Well, I would say that people naturally were conscious, you know, of the risks they were running, but only on one occasion did I ever hear of anyone being taken off a crew for what they called LMF, which was loss of moral fiber. The boys faced the music, I think, with the best attitude. I remember one lad who was, I won't say psychic, because there's every kind of a meaning attached to that word, but he was definitely superstitious, and he had what he called his own chop list. That was the list of crews which were going to go missing on this squadron. And this was a kind of a gruesome or ghoulish type of pastime. But his own crew was on the chop list, and as things worked out, they went missing. I don't know what happened to them. But that was a sort of a bizarre type of pastime for anyone to... and a lot of... the older ones among us, we rather laughed about it, you know, and, you know, wondered what was behind his thinking, or whether he actually did have some sixth sense.
What was the physical plant of the base like?